Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Kirsten Reinford, the founder of Joshua Farm, an organic urban farm in the city of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. This is the second of the series on beginning farming. If you'd like to hear the first episode on this topic, check out my interview with Aaron Harvey, which was posted on January 24, 2013. I wanted to speak with Kirsten on this subject because of her candor and some of her conversations about what it's like to run a farm. Yet, I didn't know her story or that of Joshua Farm. We've shared lunch at a farm tour and spoke about broader issues involving urban farming in Harrisburg, our state capital. We've attended the same meetings involving local initiatives where Kirsten asked pointed questions and provided personal insights. In many ways, she's a mainstay of the regional sustainable farming community, and I'm thankful she's here. Her passion for farming and devotion to this work is ever present. I found this out when, during our interview, her doorbell rang. I paused the conversation as she answered the door, and there was a customer to pick up their CSA share at nearly 9 o'clock at night. That Kirsten contemplates her role as a farmer and the work of Joshua Farm is also apparent. I say that because I think this is the least I've spoken during an interview. Each time I was ready to interject and ask a question, her narrative continued in the direction I was going to direct us, and the unspoken question had an answer. Lastly, among my many reasons for interviewing Kirsten is that I had visited Joshua Farm. For those of you who follow the show on Facebook, you've already seen some pictures from my time there. I'm including some of those in the show notes for this episode. That ability to visit Kirsten at her farm gave me a better understanding of her work and how that could fit into an episode and be useful to you, the listeners. One more thing before we begin. This show is listener-supported. Your generous donations or recurring monthly micropayments help me to continually improve the show, as well as set funds aside for use as permaculture scholarships. Find out how to help by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Kirsten. I'll join you afterwards with more information and updates.
Then if you're ready, if you could give us a little bit about your background and how you came to run an urban farm in Harrisburg.
My name is Kirsten Reinford, and I grew up on a gentleman's farm in Lebanon County. My family had 130 acres, but we rented most of that land out to the neighbor farm for corn, soybeans, and heifers. We had some horses and chickens. I remember having a garden as a child. I don't remember eating much from the garden. Whether I've blocked that out because of it not liking vegetables, or whether it's actually true that we didn't eat much or harvest much from the garden, I'm not sure. I do remember that there were multiple times where we went on a vacation for the summer or for a week and came back to find that the weeds had taken over the garden or the neighbor's cows had gotten out and trampled and eaten things. So while I came from a rural background, I didn't grow up in a farming family, and I knew the rhythms of the season, but not the particulars of what to plant when and how to take care of all kinds of different things. Fast forward to college. I went to college in Virginia and ended up with a major in liberal arts and minors in missions and sociology. I also explored teaching English as a second language. And then after college, I had a variety of different jobs and ended up moving to Harrisburg with my husband. We were pretty committed to living in the city at that time, wanting to be part of a city revitalization, feeling that cities had been kind of abandoned by middle-class people and that cities needed some citizens who had resources to contribute in a variety of different ways. We also liked the diversity of the city and the fact that it's very walkable, that we could walk to work, the church, to the grocery store if needed, school, to neighbors' houses. So even though living in a city in a small house with a very small backyard makes it hard to practice a lot of gardening, it did feel like we were reducing our carbon footprint in a different way. I worked for a couple of years at our church, and during that time I had a membership in a CSA in York County, about an hour away. And I had a working share, so I would go down once a week and work for 4 hours in exchange for my food. And it was a long way to drive for organic produce, but I could make it more rational in my head by dropping my son off at my mother's house, and she lived nearby to that CSA. So it worked out that it was more than just food. It was building relationships and combining errands, let's say. So I really enjoyed that experience, and that was my first real experience with any kind of large-scale vegetable operation. Goldfinch Farm is the name of that CSA, and they have about 8 acres. They've grown over the years to have about 200 CSA members. And I got to do a little bit of everything, planting, weeding, harvesting, and it was quite a different experience from my day job, which was working with people and volunteers and children. And so the contrast between that setting and being out in the field, enjoying nature, getting my hands in the dirt, was really striking to me. And like I said, I really enjoyed that. About that time, after being there for about 3 years, my family made the decision to sell the land in Lebanon County. And my husband and I decided to explore the option of purchasing it. We were concerned that if we didn't purchase it, then somebody would buy it and turn it into a development, because that area of the county is being rapidly developed. So we started exploring farming for real. And I knew I didn't want to be a dairy farmer, because that requires altogether too much commitment. And I wasn't into the commodity things, because I still don't understand the stock market. And I had some experience with this vegetable farm, so that seemed like a good direction to go. But as we started to crunch the numbers, we realized that spending $450,000 on a farm and then having debt payments of, you know, $2,000 a month or whatever it would have been was just not going to work for us. My husband's a social worker, and, you know, we're pretty committed to living simply. We hadn't stored up a lot of savings. So it became clear that was not going to happen. And so it was with a great deal of reluctance that we realized that we just could not purchase that farm, and we had to trust that whoever did purchase it would take care of it the way that we hoped we could have. Fortunately, a Mennonite family bought it, and as far as I know, they are actually farming it, and it has not been developed. But the process of exploring farming really got me thinking about what it would be like to farm somewhere else, perhaps closer to where we had settled in Harrisburg. And I attended a conference at one point, this was in 2003 or 2004, and met somebody at that conference who ran an urban farm in Pittsburgh. And I was very intrigued by this idea, because as I had mentioned, we were committed to living in the city, but I was also interested in farming. And so for the next year, whenever we traveled, we made it a point to visit whatever urban farms we could find. And there's quite a few of them now. Back in 2004 and 2005, there weren't as many. We were able to visit Greensgrove Farm in Philadelphia, Summerton Tank Farm in Philadelphia, the Food Project in Boston, the Chicago Resource Center in Chicago, Grow Pittsburgh, Mildred's Daughter's Urban Farm in Pittsburgh as well. And so got a sense of like, wow, this is really neat. Like, people are doing this in the city, and maybe we could do it too. So one day I was out for a walk with my son, who was a year and a half at the time, I think, and he grew in a stroller, and the sidewalks in our city are pretty atrocious. So I was going down an alley, and I came across this large field, which I had probably seen before, but it registered in my head in a different way at that point. And I thought that this would be a perfect spot for an urban farm. And I wasn't quite sure how it was all going to work out, but I knew that I wanted to do a CSA model because I liked the relationship part of it. I liked having your produce essentially pre-sold and the guaranteed income part of it from a business perspective. And so I began the process of trying to acquire this land. I found out that it was owned by the Harrisburg School District. It had previously been the athletic field for a junior high school that had closed in the mid-70s. And so since, you know, 1974 or thereabouts, the field had been basically abandoned. There had been a couple seasons where neighbors had block parties, but then it became overgrown and it was kind of a dumping ground for sofas and mattresses and all kinds of broken glass and a bunch of auto parts as well. So I took a business planning class and tried to put together a little proposal for the school district to use that land as a community-supported agriculture program. The school district said, well, you'll need to be a nonprofit organization and you'll need to work with youth, and we'll think about it. So it took about, they started thinking about it, and I started developing a nonprofit organization. But that quickly became overwhelming, and I realized that starting a nonprofit organization is a really big endeavor to develop a board and devote energy and resources to keeping the board happy and involved, as well as accomplishing the mission. About that time, a friend of mine who worked for an organization called Joshua Group approached me, and Joshua Group is an organization that works with at-risk youth in the city of Harrisburg, primarily through after-school tutoring programs, GED tutoring, some financial support for students to attend private schools, and they had offered a residential program for a season or two. So Joshua Group worked with youth and had been trying to develop a micro-enterprise endeavor, and they had explored some different options and nothing was working out. So they asked if I wanted to partner with them so that I could be under their nonprofit umbrella and employ their youth. And that seemed like a pretty good arrangement to me. So we presented that option to the school district, and it was approved. And so we were officially given permission to use the land in 2005, in the fall of 2005. So at that point, it's kind of funny to look back on it. I didn't have much at all. And so I remember I hired somebody with a tractor to come in and rototill the field. I was planning to plant some cover crops for the fall, and I had this little broadcast feeder thing that I spread the seed with, and then I needed to incorporate it just a little bit. But, you know, the field is about an acre, and we didn't start out with the whole thing, but it was a good chunk of land that we were working with, and so I started with a rake and realized that wasn't going to work, and so then I found a chain link fence piece and attached some chain to it and tried to pull that around, but it kept bouncing around, so I put a cinder block on it. And yeah, like I said, it's just kind of funny to, you know, think about what I started with. We did plant garlic that first year in that fall, and then in 2006, we launched our CSA. We started with 12 members who came for about 20 weeks during the growing season, and we had 3 youth from Joshua Farm that were employed at the field. They worked about 15 hours a week, and their salary was subsidized by a grant from a local bank. The 12 members were mostly friends of mine who were willing to take a risk on a kind of crazy idea. As you could hear from my, you know, my biography, I didn't go to school for farming. I didn't have an internship anywhere. I read lots of books and went to the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture conferences and visited as many farmers as I could, but I was really kind of flying by the seat of my pants. That year, I planted 75 row feet of eggplants, and I've never planted any more eggplants over the years as our CSA has grown. That has proved to be a sufficient amount for a lot of people. You know, I had some of the normal problems. You know, some crops did really well, and my CSA members were inundated with cucumbers, and other crops were kind of disappointing. But, you know, people gave me pretty good feedback, and we said, let's keep doing this. So each year then, we grew bit by bit. And the farm, Joshua Farm, is located in a pretty urban area. I mean, it's obviously in the city, but it's in a neighborhood in Harrisburg that has a high percentage of people living in poverty. The school lunch rate, the number of students in Harrisburg School District who received free or reduced school lunches is about 90%. So it's pretty significantly depressed. And I was concerned from the beginning about the potential for the farm to become an elitist proposition. So after the first year, we sold some extras at a little table next to the farm. But then in 2007, we kind of started a farm stand in earnest and wanted to make sure that people from the neighborhood could participate in the farm and that it wasn't this walled fortress that they couldn't access or they couldn't enjoy. So we had a little farm stand in the parking lot, and that's gone through various seasons. We did get some grant money from the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture in 2008 to expand that farm stand and do some more marketing. And we sold our own produce at that, as well as produce that we purchased from other local farms. So we would get things that either we didn't grow, like fruit, or things that we didn't have enough of in order to have a good, well-balanced display. And then in 2011, we added a second farm stand at a retail center in Harrisburg called Strawberry Square. And there's a lot of offices there, as well as a university. And so people come there on their lunch break for the food court, and then hopefully also to purchase produce from Joshua Farm. So that's been very well received. So in this coming year, 2013, we're planning on having 40 shareholders in our CSA and going to the farmer's market to our farm stand at Strawberry Square once a week. And then we're also looking at adding a second farm stand. We stopped doing the farm stand in our parking lot last year. I'm feeling like it was taking a lot of energy to run that, and the returns were not worth the amount of time that you're putting into it. Let me think. So the youth have continued to be an important part of Joshua Farm, and each summer we hire youth who are already involved in Joshua Group's other program. So the way that works is sometime in April or May, I usually make a presentation to the youth of the after-school program, let them know about the opportunity, and if they're interested, they can fill out an application, and then we do interviews. Last year, we did have to shift to a stipend model because we realized that from a business perspective, paying youth $8 an hour to do work that took them twice as long to do as an adult was not a financially sustainable model, and we didn't have additional grants to fund that. So they do get a stipend. And some of the youth that work at the farm attend private schools, and their tuition is sponsored by Joshua Group. So it's an opportunity for them to give back to the organization, as well as to get some job skills for their future. The youth program has taken various shapes over the years. Some years we've had a significant focus on education and visiting other farms and talking about the why and wherefore of sustainable agriculture. But more recently, it's been more focused on production and trying to get the job done and get it done quickly. One thing that we did start and have continued to do is a weekly cooking class with the youth. So usually on Fridays, two of the youth and an adult volunteer will prepare lunch for all of the people who are working at the farm that day using produce from the farm. And it's a great opportunity for the kids to learn kitchen skills, to be able to eat the fruits of their labor, and to increase their consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's pretty neat when you have kids working at a farm stand and a customer comes up and says, well, what should I do with Swiss chard? I've never tried it before. And the kids can give them a recipe option that they themselves have eaten and enjoyed. So that's a good feeling. The other element of Joshua Farm is that we do a fair amount of education, and we call it service learning. And we try to make our service learning accessible to students of all ages. So we have preschool groups from the local elementary and Head Start that come to visit. We also have a good relationship with a local college called Messiah College that sends out students on a weekly basis to fulfill their service learning obligations. We host all kinds of groups, whether it's church youth groups or Boy Scouts or corporate volunteer days. We host other classes from private schools or public schools. So last year, I think we hosted between 30 and 40 different groups throughout the year. And it's not something that we've really advertised because it's a challenge sometimes to take time out of our planting, weeding, and harvesting schedule to host those groups, but we think that it's really important for people to interact with the farm, to know that it's there, and to start making some of the connections, specifically for the younger students, connections between soil and food, and for them to understand that everything that we eat comes from the soil, and that presentations that you see in the supermarket are not where food starts. Joshua Farm is not certified organic. We do follow the rules of organic certification for the most part. we also are kind of toying with some permaculture ideas, but I wouldn't say that the farm is based on permaculture principles. We do things like cover crops, green manures. We do a lot of on-farm composting, both crop waste as well as kitchen waste from my kitchen and a local restaurant. We use drip irrigation primarily as a way to conserve water. And we do have a rainwater collection system that collects the water from our greenhouse and our high tunnel and stores it in some tanks. That has the capacity for 4,500 gallons of water storage when it's functioning. It's been broken for a little bit now. I need to find a plumber to fix it. And then we try to plant perennials and beneficial plants around the perimeter of the farm so that there is habitat for the good bugs. We practice crop rotation. We grow most of our crops seeds. We got a greenhouse in 2008, and that's been a really wonderful thing. It's an unheated greenhouse. It doesn't have a furnace. So we have some forced manure hotbeds that we use in the early spring. We also have some 50-gallon barrels filled with water to act as a thermal storage. And then we use electric heat mats under some things. And we don't have the earliest tomatoes in the world, but thus far, with that combination of heat mats and water storage and the horse manure hotbed, we've been able to keep things alive in the greenhouse. We added a high tunnel in 2010 that was purchased with the assistance of the USDA NRCS program, Natural Resource and Conservation Service program. They've been doing a big high tunnel program, and that's a 30 by 72 structure that has a combination of raised beds and in-ground growing, and that has enabled us to extend our season. We harvested 12 months of the year this past year, and it's amazing. I'm a big fan of high tunnels. I know that they have some drawbacks, but they've really helped us, and it's also really nice to have a place to work on rainy days, and especially when we've got volunteers or groups that are visiting.
You've given a great introduction to yourself and Joshua Farm and walked us through a lot of what I got to see when I was on the farm there for the tour that morning as you were preparing volunteers for your workday. And I've gotten to share some of those pictures through the Facebook page with listeners, and I'll be including them in the show notes for this episode. Not having a background in farming, but kind of making a go at it and finding your successes along the way, what has this process been like for you to work through between attending the conferences and reading books and things and translating that into on-the-ground farming?
The USDA classifies new and beginning farmers as farmers who have had up to 10 years of experience, and I've got 7 under my belt. So I'm very clearly a beginning farmer. I feel every season, almost every day, that I just have so much to learn about the interactions in the soil and the way that plants respond to different things and the way that insects play a role in things and pests and disease management, and it gets a little overwhelming. But the farm is functioning, so I've learned some things along the way. I think a big thing for me has been planning, and the CSA model is perhaps not the recommended way to start a farm because there are a couple factors that make it challenging. One is that you have to grow such a wide variety of produce so that your customers, don't get bored of the same thing every week. And two, that you need to have sufficient quantity each week for your customers over a number of weeks. An alternative perhaps would be going to a farmer's market where you take what you've got. And if you're not able to harvest something that day for whatever reason, it's not a big deal. You might lose money you won't make money by not selling things. There's a different kind of pressure. So the CSA has been kind of a crash course. And for the planning for that, what I have done, and I've taken, looked at a number of different CSAs. There's a farm in New York that will come, Roxbury Farm, has some good resources for CSA planning. So I basically map out what I want my shareholders to get every week for the entire season. For us, it's 22 weeks. And then I use that as a guide to count backwards and figure out, okay, if they're going to get, you know, spinach, lettuce, carrots, scallions, and arugula on June 15th, when do those things need to be planted? And so it's a pretty big process each winter that we go through to figure out, you know, what needs to be planted when. Obviously, some things like tomatoes and peppers, you just have to plant once, but other things we do a lot of succession planting on, you know, beans, carrots, we do salad mix every week, we do scallions multiple times, you know, so all kinds of stuff gets planted more than once. And then it becomes a challenge to figure out how to fit those things into the space that we have. You know, we just have an acre and we're growing pretty intensively on that. So there's, you know, certainly if we had a larger farm, or I guess we could choose to do this now, but we haven't, you know, we could have an area be in cover crop for 2 or 3 years or have animals graze on it or whatever, and then put it into production and have kind of a bigger rotation. We have a pretty tight rotation on our crops. So I call it Sudoku on steroids, which is the process I go through every winter, trying to figure out where I'm going to plant things and how much and when they're going to get planted. And then you have to figure out what kind of things to plant. You know, you get catalogs like Tomato Grower Supply that have thousands of different kinds of tomatoes in that all have beautiful pictures and mouth-watering descriptions. And so it becomes pretty tricky. You know, so we have experimented. There's been some years where we've grown 25 different kinds of tomatoes. And this year we've decided to cut back and grow 12 kinds. I have farmer friends who grow only heirloom varieties or open pollinated varieties, and we've made the choice to grow some hybrids. We're kind of feeling like, well, life is full of compromises, as much as we would like to hold to our ideals. And so growing intensively in the city, we've decided to make yield a pretty high value, as well as flavor and disease resistance. So by choosing things that are disease resistant, we aren't tempted to use pesticides, even organically approved ones. And we haven't put a lot of energy into seed saving. That would be something that we could explore more. I think one of the challenges of farming is, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do, but there's a cost to everything. And sometimes that cost is time. You know, like saving seeds is free, essentially. It just takes time. You have to leave. You know, if you're saving seeds for carrots, you need to leave them in the ground for the second year. And so that's time in the field, and then it's your time of harvesting and sorting those seeds. So in theory, it's free, but I've decided that my time is valuable. So there are some things that I do, I take shortcuts on, you know, and there's ways perhaps that the farm could have a smaller budget, you know, if we solicited more donations or, you know, we could get by with less tools or less quality tools, but I've decided for some things that it's worth the investment. Speaking of investment, we've spent a lot of energy developing infrastructure, and I think I was caught off guard at how much energy it takes to do that. You know, when we started the farm, we had a 10 by 20 canopy, and we had, you know, some scrap tables, and we washed our produce in Rubbermaid bins. And we had some storage things, but generally we harvested everything the same day that it was sold or that it was picked up by the CSA members. And, you know, we had the standard rakes and trowels and shovels. We did get a grant to purchase a BCF rototiller that has a 30-inch rototiller attachment. But then over the years, you know, it kind of blossomed from there or grown from there. We've added the greenhouse, as I mentioned. We added a walk-in cooler in 2010, and that's been a really nice addition. It's allowed us to space out our harvest throughout the week instead of having to be in a frenzy on the same day that we're distributing produce. We added the high tunnel. We put in some water lines when we started. We had a hose from my house across the alley that was hooked into our drip irrigation system. And, you know, we've invested in some other tools like a earthway seeder, a pinpoint seeder, We've gotten some different kinds of wheel hose and stirrup hose that have all, you know, I think paid for themselves, but they are investments. And when I think about starting a farm from scratch, it is a little overwhelming sometimes to remember all that needs to happen, you know, and everything that we've purchased over the years to get it where it is now. We also use a lot of row cover. We've had good success with a special kind of row cover called Protect Net that's pretty expensive. We use the Johnny's Hoop Bender to bend metal EMT pipes into hoops. So those are just some examples of things that we've invested in. The other thing I would point out about farming and that I've learned, people think that a small farm is not very much work, but the reality is that it's not any less kinds of work than a large farm. We're just doing everything for a shorter amount of time. So because we grow such a wide variety of vegetables, there's an inherent inefficiency in the farm because, you know, there's so many different things growing and so many different kinds of care that things need. So, like I said, even though it's less work relative, you know, like 1 acre is less work to manage than a 10-acre farm, it's not any less kind. We still have rototilling and harvesting and pruning and washing and, you know, everything that you do on a large farm, you do on a small farm, except most of it gets done by hand on our farm. So that's been a challenge as we've tried to figure out the financial sustainability piece of the farm. I mean, certainly we are producing a lot of produce on our little 1 acre, but it's not matching the amount of work that's been put into it yet.
When you say that, is that relative to the amount of actual financial income that comes into the farm from selling that produce to try to support the people who are working there from it?
Right. So to expand on that a little bit, last year the farm produced about $30,000 worth of produce that was sold through our CSA and through our farm stands. And $30,000 is a lot of produce to produce on 1 acre. But that had, you know, that included one person working full-time, myself working part-time, the 3 youth during the summer, and then all of the expenses, you know, insurance, seeds, gasoline, you know, the Eagle gasoline for the rototiller, you know, equipment, electricity, supplies. We spend an exorbitant amount on supplies, you know, hoses, all kinds of things. Harvest bins, etc. So, you know, that $30,000 gets eaten up pretty quickly, and we're able to function because we have people who work here have other ways of supporting themselves, and so they're able to work for less than they should be paid. But we would like to move toward paying people a living wage, and I think one of the challenges is that industrial agriculture is so efficient that it's really hard to compete with that on a small scale. And again, there's also the challenge then of not wanting our food to become elitist. And so trying to walk that line of paying workers a living wage while not pricing our food out of the ballpark for a lot of people is a little difficult to navigate.
And that's still a road that you're walking down trying to figure out as you bring all these pieces together. Would there be a way to raise the income for the farm by diversifying some of the other products that you're producing on site? Or, like, do you have a roadmap for the direction that you want to go to try to bring about that kind of financial sustainability, or is that something you're still trying to work out?
One of the things that we're experimenting with this year is doing what we're calling a venture crop or an enterprise crop. And so we've identified 7 or 8 crops that we can grow well and that are in high demand at our market. And those crops, I think, include spinach, salad mix, Swiss chard, kale and collards, cherry tomatoes, basil, and then a little bit of carrots is the other one. And so we're experimenting this year. We are continuing with our CSA and with our market, but we've also set aside some land to experiment with these crops. The theory being that if we can grow those things well and find a good outlet for them, We may choose in the future to drop the CSA model and focus on those crops, and then we would be able to have a more efficient operation, and we'd be selling things that have a higher dollar value. So, for example, for the CSA, you know, we grow cabbage in the fall because it's, you know, cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower. We grow all of those. But those things are in the ground a long time. They don't get very much money for them. So I think 100 square feet of cabbage, you know, if you have a good harvest, you might get $30 for that. But if you have 100 square feet of salad mix, you could get between $300 and $400 for that, especially including the fact that the cabbage is in the ground for a longer time and you could do multiple plantings of salad mix during that time. So, like I said, we're exploring the option of growing a smaller variety of crops in larger quantities. That would change our marketing structure significantly because we would no longer be able to operate a CSA. We wouldn't have the diversity of crops necessary. So that may lead us to a cooperative CSA with other farms or to some wholesale sales or selling to restaurants, that kind of thing, or, you know, going to just farmers markets with what we've got. You know, in terms of other ways to diversify, I mean, we did try, one thing that we tried was a blueberry planting. I had the theory that, okay, blueberries are a native plant. Organic blueberries are very expensive. They get picked at the time when we have our youth during the summer, and other than that, they don't require a whole lot of attention. So we planted 75 blueberry plants a couple years ago, thinking that that might be a way. We decided not to plant the whole field in blueberries because that would just be plain boring and not diverse enough. But anyway, we've experimented with that. Unfortunately, the blueberries have not done very well, and we have not been able to harvest anything from them yet. And they're one of the crops that has kind of gotten neglected. So I think the challenge of finding time to do everything that needs to be done is a real one. You've got the tyranny of the urgent, that's a pretty strong force at work. You know, there's also people who talk about doing value-added products, whether that's making preserves or jams or pickles or those sorts of things. And that just feels like, in theory, we could do that, but we would need to find access to a kitchen. And most of that work gets done at the height of the season. And so it's hard to imagine where there would be time to, you know, after spending all week harvesting, selling stuff, to then spend a couple hours in a hot kitchen making things. This does not sound very appealing to me. I've drawn some boundaries to the farm. It's really like another child. So there's things we could do to get more money, but they also require more work. And we haven't felt that the payoff is that great yet. You know, certainly we've explored aquaponics. I know that's kind of a big buzzword among sustainable circles these days. I'm not a big fan of hydroponics, but in the aquaponic setting, I could see that working. It's just a matter of, like, initial startup funding and, you know, trying to figure out all the pieces involved in that and developing a market for the fish and troubleshooting. And it feels like a pretty big project if we would do it on any kind of scale. So I'm certainly open to suggestions. You know, one of the reasons I enjoy visiting farms is because I get to see how people are wrestling with the financial sustainability piece and what they're doing, you know, to make it work for them. And there's, I think, a fair number of farmers who have just decided that, you know, it's okay if they live below the poverty line because they have a good life. And I respect that. And especially if people can come into land through family or can find a rental agreement, you know, that seems like a really good option. But here in the city, we feel a strong obligation to pay people for their work.
When you were looking at doing your enterprise crop exploration as you're trying to figure out, like, what the value is, you mentioned, like, you know, cabbage, 100 square feet provides you a certain amount of revenue. Doing something like salad greens in that same amount of space provides you a different revenue. Is that part of your planning process, that you sit down and you go through the numbers at the end of every season to see what you sold at what rate, to try to plan on what could be valuable for the next year? Is that a lot of processing of information that you're doing directly from your farm, Or is that also observation from the farmers markets?
Record keeping has been a challenge for us. In theory, we should be tracking all kinds of information about the farm. You know, I would like to be tracking all of the inputs for various crops, you know, how much the potting soil costs and how much time it takes to seed them in the greenhouse and then to transplant them in the field and then how much time it takes to harvest them. And there's some great resources out there that give some guidance about how to do that. The Organic Farmer's Business Handbook is a good book along those lines. We've wrestled with record keeping, and I think that's one of the challenges, again, of being so diverse and growing so many different things is, you know, when you're measuring things in minutes instead of hours or quarter hours, it just feels overwhelming to try to track all of that information. But we do keep track of our harvest, and we'd like to keep track better of what specific thing was harvested, like what variety, you know, we just write down salad mix, for example, or tomatoes, and how many pounds of tomatoes we pick that day instead of breaking out all the different kinds of tomatoes that we grow. So we're trying with that. We had started to use a program called Ag Squared, which I think had a lot of potential for helping farmers with some of the planning process. And my hope was that they were going to have some forms on that program for recording harvest and yield, and then that would be an easier way to look at the information and to analyze it in order to make adjustments for next year's plans. Last time that I checked, they did not have that harvest information, the harvest forms, as part of the program yet. So it's a challenge. I think, again, the CSA model, one of the, as I've said a number of times, you know, one of the challenges is having such a diverse variety of things that you need to grow. So if I were doing it again, I'd have to think long and hard about whether I would do a CSA model or whether I would focus on a couple crops that I knew I could do well and find a market for them, because I think there's something to be said for keeping things streamlined and for being more aware of your input for various crops.
I haven't said much during this because you've walked through so many of the things that I wanted to talk with you about when I first approached you about wanting to learn more about your road as a farmer and Joshua Farms, as we've known each other a couple of years now, but that was my first visit just a few weeks ago to the farm and to see the work that you're doing on the ground. As we record this, it's an evening after we've both had long days. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation for the listeners before I thank you for your time and bring this to a close?
I think it's an exciting time to be a farmer. It does seem that there is a lot of energy, a lot of good resources and networks, and a greater level of consumer awareness and appreciation for how food is grown. So that's exciting. I still think that being financially sustainable is a challenge for a lot of farms. And I would encourage people as consumers to think about the investment that they're making. I like to remind people that, you know, every time you buy something, you're voting. And so, you know, every time you buy food, you're voting for the kind of food system that you want. And I understand that people who have very limited resources may not feel like they have the option to vote or to purchase, you know, locally grown organic produce. But I think a lot of people do have the option to consider that and have the resources to make that choice. And so I encourage people to do that and appreciate those who already are. And, you know, if you're thinking about farming, I just encourage you to connect with other farmers. I know that Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture has started a mentoring program specifically geared for women, but open to others as well. And I presume that other states have similar programs. I hear about new farmers networks. And so I think there's a lot of resources out there, but I also encourage you to count the costs and figure out what your goals are. So, you know, is it a money goal? Is it a lifestyle goal? Is it a warm, fuzzy feeling? Is it, you know, to be self-sufficient? Or, you know, how much energy are you willing to put into something? So visit farms and gather as much information as you can. And then at some point, if you're going to jump, jump big.
Thank you for giving that broad viewpoint of the different places people can come from when considering why farming could be important to them, and that encouragement to make the transition when they feel that they're ready. Kirsten, thank you so much for taking the time to join me. I really appreciate getting to hear more of your story and understanding how all of these pieces fit together in the world of urban agriculture in Harrisburg, and also just in agriculture in general for people who are working on a very small scale.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Kirsten Reinford. As you heard, the road she's on after 7 years is still the beginning of the journey. Along the way, each year brings new challenges, decisions, and rewards. There were some things that Kirsten mentioned to me that she wanted added to the conversation that we missed during the interview proper. One of those is about spin farming, which is a program designed to get a small-scale farm up and running profitably in a very short amount of time. Though Kirsten doesn't agree with everything in this method, there are some pieces that you may find useful. There's some information on the website for this program, though most of the content appears to be made available through purchased PDF downloads or books at various price points, with the total package running several hundred dollars. I can't speak to the content or value of this product, and I'm not endorsing it in any way, but you can find out more by going to spinfarming.com and taking a look around. There's a mix of freely available content to get you started and see if you might be interested in learning more. Her other recommendation I have noted here is for Growing for Market magazine, which offers numerous resources for farmers who grow to sell their product. I'm not familiar with it beyond Kirsten's mention, but when I went to the main page of the website, there was Richard Wiswall with a recommendation for the magazine. You can find out more at growingformarket.com. I mention Richard Wiswall because Kirsten brought up his book, The Organic Farmer's Business Handbook. For the number of times I've heard this book mentioned, from guests and when speaking with people in person, it seems like the perfect place to start your research into the business of starting your own farm. I also looked into the Ag Squared farm planning software to check out the current feature set. At this time, that includes interactive farm map, crop planner, planting calculators, daily calendar, smart scheduling, farm journal, and a spreadsheet importer. And that's all supported with extensive training materials and email support, but does not include harvest tracking at this time. I think that's probably where the spreadsheet importer comes in. You can check out a free trial that lasts 30 days at agsquared.com. Should you choose to purchase it, the price is $60 a year. As a technology dork, I like that this is web-based, which makes it accessible across many mediums, including a computer, tablet, or smartphone. If, while listening to this show, you have any questions, please let me know. You can leave a comment in the show notes for this episode, send me a message on Twitter, where I am at permaculturecst, or through the Facebook page, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Or, of course, there's always email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. Now then, some updates from me about the show. First, thanks to your donations, I recently invested in some additional recording equipment. I can now be somewhat portable, allowing me to do on-site interviews with guests, or even to set up at an event and do a recording. I'm working with a local farmer to schedule the first such on-site session and give it a real-world test run. Also, due to some conversations with listeners on Facebook and Twitter, there's a desire for me to cover topical material that goes beyond the basics that can be covered in an interview or what's readily available in the permaculture literature. There were also requests for book reviews. To that end, I'm going to release one interview a week each Tuesday moving forward. To let you know, I've already recorded the following interviews. Here they are with release dates. Ben Falk comes on, and we discuss his company Whole System Design, Observation in Permaculture, and his forthcoming book about the sustainable homestead. That episode comes out on May 28. Wayne Herring joined me to talk about his work over the last 6 years of starting a sustainable family farm. That will be out on June 4th. Nathaniel Mulcahy of World Stove talks with me about World Stove and his work to develop and distribute pyrolytic stoves that not only cook food efficiently, but also produce biochar to aid the replenishment of the soil. That's out on June 11th. From there, I'll be reading, researching, and writing shows that delve deeper into the subjects you, the listeners, want to know more about, while continuing to do interviews with a regular release. However, these topical episodes and the book reviews will be not quite as regular. However, will be released on Fridays. Though, I think if I get enough material together, the book reviews may wind up getting their own release day. However it works out, the topic-based episodes and book reviews will be coming out in their own time. The first of these topical episodes is about bioremediation, and the book I'm currently reading for review is Thinking Like a Mountain, An Ecological Perspective on Earth by R. Edward Grumbine. And that's an excerpted and updated ebook from his 1994 book, Ghost Bears. For those of you interested in the online PDC Plus, I opened pre-registration to those who contact me directly about the course, and I'm holding that open for them until the morning of May 25th. I'll share the public registration URL with everyone and let you know how many spaces are left on June 1st. Now, to cover the legal and wrap up this episode, the Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works license. Or to put that in simple terms, feel free to share it with whoever you like, but make sure you tell them where you got it from, and don't sell it or change it. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.